Welcome, everybody, to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Pastor Desi White of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemelman of First City Church in Bellevue, Nebraska. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're diving into the second part of our conversation that we started last week called Donald Trump, Populism, and Nationalism.
And we are recording this in advance, so I always say as a disclaimer, who knows what might happen in the days between when we record this and when it's released. The news changes every day. But we want to tackle this week especially some of the cultural changes and cultural fractures that were revealed in the election of Donald Trump. Populism and nationalism are the sort of the two ways to get at that. That's why we chose that title for the podcast. So on one hand, you have sort of a populist uprising, especially among the white working class, that we want to talk about. And why is it that there's a whole population in our country that found Trump to be a bullhorn for their concerns? And then secondly, what about nationalism? And even what about, is it okay to be a nationalist? Can you be a nationalist? Can you care about national identity, national culture? Or is that in itself an expression of sort of privilege? So those are the two pieces that I guess we want to talk about in relation to the demographics of the election. A lot of people have said this, but I want to say it on the podcast just to be clear. Yes, there are some scary people who voted for and supported Trump. There are also a lot of really normal average Americans who voted for and supported Trump. And if in our dialogue about Trump and about what he represents, we undermine the fact that a lot of people voted for him for very valid reasons, I think we miss one of the things we need to learn from this election, which is, and you know, thankfully, some of the media have already sort of been policing themselves, reassessing how they talk about Trump and the people who voted for him. Hillary Clinton, of course, made the mistake of calling everybody a basket of deplorables who was sort of in Trump's camp, or at least half of them. And I think that was an indication of what those people have felt, is like, well, if I don't have a voice and if that's how the cultural left is going to view me, then fine, I'll speak with a loud bullhorn. So we want to say on the front, I tweeted shortly after the election, beware of associating Trump's win with Trump's rhetoric. Many who voted for him were simply voting for change. I really believe that's true. There's a lot of people who voted for Trump who aren't into Trump and aren't even into how he sees the world entirely, but felt a need for dramatic change and felt that they needed someone who could sort of take a whip maybe to the sort of established ways of doing things in Washington. And certainly it seems that they got that. Chris, what are your thoughts on the you've been sort of tweeting a lot about sort of the populist side of things and sort of the rural vote and the white working class vote and some of those elements which spoke loudly in this election. What do you see there?
I think one of the most shocking things that came out of the election night is how the Democrats lost a voting block that they assumed they had. That how many years has it been associated that the white working class votes Democratic, especially within the last, you know, 15, 20 years or so. So the fact that there was a whole voting block that jumped ship and went to Donald Trump, a guy who is in no means a conventional conservative at all, says something. And the fact that the guy is a New York billionaire, I mean, mogul, you know, builds these giant hotels and casinos. I mean, he's not exactly, you know,
your average working guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Down the street.
So he's not like, grew up in a farm, you know, and I still wear cowboy boots. You know, George Bush was more folksy than Donald Trump. So
I made a lot of money and I'm good at it.
So there is a sense
was
where.
That your Trump impersonation?
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
Yeah, okay. I was not even close. <Cut that>. So the fact that this voting bloc jumped ship and followed a guy like Donald Trump says that there was something going on within this demographic where the policies of the Obama administration and other liberal policies were massively missing. And that's telling. And that to me was particularly interesting because you have this whole group that was just assumed they were going to vote one way and said, hey, you haven't been listening to us. You haven't been putting in policies in our best interests, and all of a sudden it's just, hey, we're gonna go after this guy who says that America first, American jobs, that we matter as a demographic now, and so for Trump to get their vote speaks volumes, I think, of what the Democrats weren't doing.
Well, here's another angle on that that some commentators have talked about. The Democrats for years have been playing identity politics, where everything's about a subgroup. Like you're gay, you're transgender, you're a minority, you're pick your sort of subgroup. And sort of the Democratic coalition has been cobbling together all these sort of identity subgroups. You know, union voters was it for a while in the early 2000s, right? You can think of all these different voting blocks. And some people have been saying, because the Democratic or especially the progressive left has approached cultural dialogue that way for years, what you had was the white working class just sort of saying, okay, we can play that game too. Like, if we're going to do identity politics, here's our identity. We're the white working class. We're the Rust Belt, Midwestern, you know, lower income white folks. We're going to speak with one voice. And so even some on the cultural left have been saying this election should be a signal. I don't know if it will be, but it should be a signal to progressives that identity politics don't work, because what they do is instead of building a national unity, they subdivide and fragment in ways that as soon as someone grabs a bullhorn and gets a hold of a cultural identity group that no one's talking to and pulls them in his direction, this is what can happen. And so it's sort of the backlash of identity politics as a strategy.
And this is the problem with the alt-right, is that they have largely staked themselves in one form or another as a white nationalist party. Now, there are some within the alt-right that are more toxic in this. I mean, they're straight up KKK, Nazi, Heil Hitler, white supremacists. And there are others that maybe it doesn't come out in such a pernicious way, but it is sort of this, hey, I'm a white working class dude or family, and we matter too. And so the identity politics has forced them to think about their own identity, not because they're necessarily going to do that on their own, but just the like you were saying, Bob, the way that the culture has made identity such a big deal. It's like, well, okay, then if this is the way the game is played, then I'm going to vote in a way that benefits my identity. And so there's a sense where this backlash against the left is a monster that they have created, and they have to live with it. And then they're going to lament, you know, the horrible excesses of the alt-right and these white nationalists. Well, it's like, well, that's the game you've been playing. And another thing that I think is interesting for a lot on the alt-right is they don't give a flip about being called racist. It doesn't work anymore. And
no,
and that's scary to some degree, where true racism, because of all the false racism and all it just being flippantly thrown around, like true racism is actually going to lose any value, any stake, and that just rots a nation to the core. So there's a lot of implications here that as we talked about last week, that are kind of scary, that have played out because of the way Democrats wanted to push identity politics.
Isn't this identity politics that you guys have been talking about, though, the same thing that the Republicans did back in the 80s with the evangelicals?
Oh, sure, yeah. We played that game as the evangelical, the moral majority or whatever that was.
So it seems like for the last 30-some-odd years, then, we're just coming full circle with everything, and we realize how divided we are. How do we move forward as a nation, then, united on principles rather than understanding that, yeah, we're going to have different identities and different convictions on those things?
It remains to be seen whether we can.
Yeah.
I think that's where the gospel has something interesting to say, because the gospel says we have a new primary identity. And so at least within the church, we can say, well, I'm not defined by a subgroup. I'm defined by identity in Christ. But yeah, nationally, we've gone so far down that road. Here's what's funny is I think the progressive left are going to have to be the people to change that, because like Chris is saying, the danger is now the alt-right is playing that game with a lot more ferocity, and I'm concerned of where that could end us up. So the progressive left is going to need to be the ones to say, hey, hold on, let's back up here. And there's even been some interesting voices. I don't know if you saw Bill Maher on TV was basically saying, hey, we were really hard on George W. Bush and on, you know, Republicans, and we shouldn't have been. Like, now there's a guy that we really should be able to be hard on, and we've spent all that capital making fun of George W. Bush, and now we have a guy that really we should be saying some things about, but people have stopped listening because we're just sort of that mockery, that progressive mockery of anything conservative, anything, you know, traditional.
And not to be a prophet of doom and gloom, because I'm not claiming to be able to read history, but if you want to talk about historically, this type of dynamic that we're experiencing in the U.S. has typically ended in a breaking apart of a nation, and in some ways, when identity politics become super extreme, then these identity groups start to break off and seek separation from the other groups in order to maintain a level of civility and safety. And so it doesn't become all out bloody civil war. So again, in our lifetime, are we going to see civil war? Well, I'm not saying that, but if history is any teacher, we have to be careful about what is on the horizon, because if you look at Europe or even in Asia, you look at the former Soviet Union, you look at Africa, that these tribal politics do not end well in many cases. So all that to say that identity politics never leads to something good.
Well, and this is a place where we can maybe start to answer your question, Mike, of just what can we do? I think here's a place where the church can lead the way. You mentioned it last week on the podcast, Chris, but it comes back to the importance of listening. Because I think that we even play this identity game, or can play it, in really detrimental ways in our personal relationships, right? When I write you off as, well, you probably already think this, and so I can just sort of factor you out and don't have to listen to you. As an example, so racism and nationalism, I think, are two topics that we need to engage, and it's hard to even engage them right now because those terms are being thrown around in so many different ways. And in fact, right after the election, there were people sort of saying, well, Trump, the victory of Trump is a victory for racism. And that started to make me frustrated, because I felt like, well, there are racists who supported Trump and voted for him. But not everybody who voted for Trump is a racist, nor did he win because everybody in America is a racist, nor is a concern for white identity necessarily racism, right? Like, some of what the white working class is reacting to is not, gosh, we're white and nobody's representing us. It has to do with jobs, identity, cultural power and influence. And so those things are always connected to ethnicity, but racism is too simplistic of an explanation. So in the church, I think we can lead a conversation about race that's nuanced, and we can also lead a conversation about nationalism that's nuanced, and we can demonstrate how to have those conversations in ways that give full voice to the things that need to be said and expressed in those conversations without reducing it to a soundbite or a tweet. Because that's the, right, like, we need to talk about race in America in a deep way, and that's going to involve disagreement, debate, discussion, different points of view, hearing, responding. That kind of conversation, I think, is a place where the church can lead and is starting to lead in good ways. That's the only way we're going to get past the identity politics to say, okay, am I defined by more than what race I am? Am I defined by more than my zip code or my cultural demographic? Am I defined by something more significant, like my ability to think rationally about reality and my ability to have dialogue about things?
So to switch this a little, let's move from race to talking about the divide between rural, urban, socioeconomic class that is also revealed. Because as many astute observers and analysts have said, that this is probably less about race and more about socioeconomic class. As several articles have pointed out, Trump got more of the Latino and African American vote than Romney. So they're that right there, not that he got a significant number, but just right there shows that this probably had less to do with race than some wanted to make it. The bigger divide was rural, urban, socioeconomic class. And so you have this, again, kind of this uprising of the small town, suburban town, saying, hey, we are tired of being led and governed by the coastal elite, if you want to use that term. And that's provocative to me too, because of one who, I spent nearly 9 years in Washington, D.C. and lived the urban lifestyle, and in many ways sort of had my thinking adjusted to more of an urban way of thinking of things. And then moving back to, I mean, Omaha is not small. There's definitely urban aspects of Omaha, but then planting in Bellevue, which is not urban. And so kind of having experienced both of these worlds recently, And I tweeted this out just a couple days after the election. I'm sitting in Panera in Bellevue and just listening to the conversations, and everything was playing out. I mean, just the way people were talking about the election, talking about Trump, even those who weren't supporting him outright, there was this sense of, yeah, he spoke for the rural, the small town, the suburban, and Hillary Clinton was all about the city and the West Coast and East Coast and the liberals. So there's obviously a divide here too that this election has exposed.
Yeah, Anthony Bradley tweeted out, if you bought into the myth that cities shape culture, you woke up on Wednesday morning really confused. Because what happened in the election is the rural America shaped culture. And so it's an interesting sort of counterpoint to sort of the Tim Keller wisdom on church planting, which is you go to the cities, you start in the cities because they're the shapers of culture. There's obviously some truth to that, but this election, I think, forces us to ask the question, okay, if all we're doing is thinking about cities and I think that's honestly where a lot of the church planting momentum has gone in the last 10 years is let's plant churches in global cities. Let's reach the cities because that's from there you reach the nations and you reach the cultural centers and you reach the universities. Yeah. But right. Obviously that's not all that matters.
So what I want to kind of throw out to our listeners to consider is that what goes on in small towns or suburban towns or more rural context, which really is our context in many ways. I mean, we have Omaha, we have Lincoln, but the vast majority of Nebraska is rural. That for us as the church, as disciples, those that care about church planting and seeing discipleship go forward, like, there has to be a very intentional, thoughtful approach to this. And there are those that are doing this, but the fact that the majority of this demographic voted for Trump says something theologically, says something about how they view politics, says something about what they value. And there's been several articles written recently about the theology of this demographic and how it does have an influence of Christianity. But if you look at their theology, they don't get the gospel clearly. There's aspects of the theology that we would say are heretical or borderline heretical. So the fact that this demographic has a theology played out in how they voted and plays out in how they live their lives in these small towns. And so there's definitely a need to see gospel preaching churches, gospel centered churches reach these areas that will then impact the way people vote and the way culture goes. So for us that like church planting, think about church planting, or engage in church planting, give to church planting, let's put this on the table as well.
Let me go even deeper there. I think we need to talk about and think about enculturation, because though a rural working class voter might not think, that might sound like too sociological or abstract a concept, I think that's actually one of the things that they're concerned about, meaning this. There's a culture that we're seeking to pass on to our kids. There's an American sort of culture. There's a Western culture. And I think what you see in this election is that there's, in classical education, we always say education is enculturation. Like you can't educate kids without passing on to them some culture. So what's always been the case in sort of Western European heritage and American heritage is that we're passing on some aspect of the culture of Greece and Rome, right? There's a classical sort of, you call it white, call it European. I don't think those are fair monikers, but I understand where they come from. This sense of the cultural heritage of the Greeks, the Romans, the Latins, the Europeans, the Roman Catholic Church, the American experiment, these things have all shaped Western culture. As has slavery in America, as has immigration, as has colonialization. There's all these. So even as minority cultures think about their story, right? The story of an African American in America is bound up with the culture of Western European civilization. It's not an either or. And so because that's the case, we've, I think, always traditionally thought about what it means to be an American as there's a culture you need to learn so that you can be a meaningful part of it. What's happened, I think, in progressive thought is they've taken away the idea of enculturation as a goal of education, or they've sought to enculturate people in different ways, right? So if you think about what happened with the redefinition of marriage and with the transgender conversation in the last 5 to 10 years, what the average rural person is waking up realizing is now what's happening is people are trying to tell my kids gay marriage is okay, being transgendered is okay. And not only these things are okay, but if you don't applaud them and celebrate them, you're somehow backwards, intolerant, bigoted, and to be sort of like dismissed. And I think people see that and go, okay, I don't agree with that. And so the voting for Trump is an enculturation piece there that says, that's not the culture I think I want to pass on to my kids. And I need someone to sort of like call time out so we can talk about what is American culture and what is it that we're trying to pass on. This is also interesting to me in the conversation about what it means to be a quote unquote white nationalist. I'm referencing a New York Times editorial from November 21st that's about white nationalism and seeks to sort of explain this movement called white nationalism, which the New York Times is saying is different than white supremacy. White supremacists want to see sort of only white people flourish. White nationalists are a little different. But there's a line in here that says, a desire to protect traditional values and culture is the strongest predictor of support for the sort of populism that propelled Trump to power. Many of these voters would not think of themselves as white nationalists, and the cultural values and traditions they seek to protect are not necessarily explicitly racial. Then the Times goes on to say, however, those traditions formed when national identity and culture were essentially synonymous with whiteness. So the impulse to protect them from social and demographic change is essentially an attempt to turn back the clock to a less diverse time. And Ross Douthat, in commenting on this article, said, I think it's dangerous to associate cultural conservatism with white nationalism, which is the move that New York Times made in that one paragraph, is to say, if you think there's any cultural values and traditions that deserve to be passed on that come from European heritage, basically you're just passing on whiteness. And I just think, nope, it's not that simple. And that's what a lot of those rural voters are saying. Okay, no, there's actually something beautiful about cultural heritage that I want to pass on, and something worth conserving. And I don't know what to call it or how to name it or how to frame it. I just know that what's happened in the last 8 years under President Obama is not the direction I want to go. And what Hillary Clinton is promising is not the direction I want to go. So I'm just interested, Chris, that I think there's an enculturation piece. There's a culture piece here. As Christians, we need to step back and ask the question, is it bad to have a culture, to be part of a nation? If it's not bad, what does it mean to be a meaningful part of a nation that's appropriately diverse, that honors every person, that welcomes every person, but that also has some sort of a distinct cultural, social identity that makes up the people that we are? And that's the question I think is a live question right now in our political discourse.
Yeah, and this is one of the ways that the alt-right really goes sideways, is because they have so closely tied this American culture or Western European culture to whiteness. They want to argue that DNA is connected to culture in a way that you cannot separate. And they try to use history and examples of other cultures and why you can't just bring a certain nationality to the United States and expect them to be enculturated. So they use these types of arguments where they try to connect those things very tightly. And that's why, because of their rhetoric, it makes what you're talking about so much more difficult. Because when you start arguing for a certain set of values, that's what people are going to hear automatically because of this identity politics thing. Again, it's, oh, I hear you talking about these traditional values and this certain type of culture. Well, this sounds a lot like the alt-right. And what they say is that's white and you're a white guy, so you're racist. So then we're back to the problem. So
is that argument going to hold up though? Because there are going to be African-American Christians out there that say the same exact things.
Yeah, I hope
that
so.
Aren't white.
Yeah.
So,
but I think Chris is right. The problem is the only sort of the things that get blown up in the cultural megaphone are sort of the alt-right version of it, because it's sort of frightening to people, and the Donald Trump version of it because it's not nuanced.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. I think that, but I guess what I'm saying, Mike, is I think this is a chance for the church to speak with some sort of nuance. And I'm thankful there are already really good writers and thinkers who are aligned both with Catholic and Protestant communities that are already starting to say some of these things in helpful ways. It's just a question of, are we going to be able to say it clearly enough and that it gains traction, that people start to ask these questions? Because I think this is, you know, even for me as a guy that started a classical school, some of the pushback we got was, well, are you telling me that like black kids need to learn Western civilization? My answer is, heck yes, because if they're going to live in the United States, that's part of the cultural tradition. It's not that they need to learn whiteness instead of blackness. It's that they need to learn the things that have shaped the dialogue of America. And yeah, I don't, has it been a beautiful dialogue, especially if you're an African American? No, it hasn't. It's been oppression and it's been subjugation. And yet, understanding the culture that has shaped all of that is important to having to taking that culture forward in meaningful ways. And so I think there's a conversation about enculturation and its role here that actually is part of what the left has devalued and what you see the rural voters saying, nope, nope, this matters. And they might not say it was sort of the, I think J.D. Vance and authors like that are saying it in intelligent ways that say, these people are seeing a loss of a culture. And the alt-right is calling it white supremacist culture, which is not. But there's a culture that now we're sort of saying, if you disenculturate a people, you take away the thing that gives them unity and that gives them coherence and cohesion. And so is every aspect of our culture beautiful? No. There's a lot of it that needs to be reformed and reshaped and changed. But when you take it away, if we don't pass on anything, or if we're trying to create it brand new every 10 years, mm-hmm. or if you're saying, hey, even though thousands and thousands of years of human culture have said marriage is this, the Supreme Court says it's that, so now it's that. Nope, we don't. Culture doesn't change that easily. And that's an important sort of dynamic that's going on in this whole electoral process.
So Washington Post editorial gets at a lot of what you're saying here, Bob. This is from a guy named Charles Camosi, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He's a professor at Fordham University. And talking about the difference between what we're calling kind of the urban and rural, the working class, and maybe it's a so-called educated class. He writes this, "While some of the political differences between educated and working class voters is based on a dispute over hard facts, the much broader and more foundational disagreements are about norms and values. They turn on first principles grounded in the very different intuitions and stories which animate very different political cultures. Such disagreements cannot be explained by the fact that college-educated voters know some facts which non-college-educated voters do not. They are about something far more fundamental. Think about the sets of issues that are often at the core of the identity of the working-class folks who elected Trump. Religion, personal liberties, relationship with government, gender, marriage, sexuality, prenatal life, and gun rights. Intuition and stories guide most working class communities on these issues. With some exceptions, those professorial sorts who form the cultures of our colleges and universities have very different intuition and stories. And the result of this divide has been to produce an educated class with an isolated, insular political culture." So again, this enculturation piece that you're talking about, Bob, what does it look like to find unity there? I mean, that's probably what is, I mean, if you could break it down, you know, there's issues of race, there's issues of socioeconomic, gender, whatever. But at the end of the day, if there's this great division in the way that we enculturate ourselves, then things like this past election are going to continue to happen one way or another. Whether it be someone like Trump or someone like Hillary or another Democrat.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to your question, Chris. It's a very good question. And I guess...
I don't have an answer either. I'm just... I think that's going to be the tension that we as a nation are going to be facing.
I hope. I think what you might be seeing... We'll see. But I think you might be seeing the breakup of the progressive left and of identity politics. Because I think that... Maybe that's run its course. I hope that's the case. And so I hope that the question you're asking of like, how do we forge what is our national identity? And how do we start from a place of what are our shared values? What are our shared convictions? Or what things are worth fighting about? You know, like that's the funny thing. If I could dial the clock back to 2013 or 2012 and the sort of debate over gay marriage, I think that I felt like as a cultural conservative, that conversation happened. The conversation didn't even happen. What I got was a reshaping I was forced to embrace a new definition of marriage that only a minority of our culture actually embraces. And so I think that's what a lot of people are feeling is this sense of, let's at least agree that some things are worth fighting about and let's have a really good fight over them versus let's have the Supreme Court mandate something and the left sort of trumpet something and then call it what we now think, because it's not what we now think. And I think what this election shows is there's a lot of Americans that are
annoyed with having been treated that way and with having been sort of talked down to and told that they're backwards and intolerant and, you know, uneducated, and that perhaps what's happening in this backlash that elected Trump is hopefully a clear signal that that's not a way forward for us. And so we're going to have to find a way to have national dialogue and robust discussion and debate and dissension about these matters.
And the sad thing is that the guy that was elected was not a populist in a good sense or in someone with strong morals. But I mean, you think about at any level of sort of human dynamics, you may not like the bully, but if the bully fights for you, you're gonna jump on his side. And so again, kind of going back to what we were saying as far as having to understand those who voted for Trump, and seeing that it wasn't just motivated out of this, you know, pure racism or this hatred of the other, but this real sense of, hey, I've been voiceless and I've been kicked to the curb and nobody's been fighting for me. And here's this guy that comes along and says he'll fight for me. And he may not be the most moral guy. He may say he's disgusting things about women. I'd never want him around my daughters, but I'm not voting for, like some people have said, I'm not voting for a pastor. I'm not voting for Mr. Nice Guy. I'm voting for someone who will fight for me. And whether rightly or wrongly, or whether he's really going to do it, that's what they feel. And that's what they sense. And so that's why they voted for him.
That's about all we've got time to say for this week. And as you can tell, there's a lot to talk about here. And there's so we'd love to hear from you listeners. If there's aspects of this that you'd like to hear more tackled from sort of a Christian perspective, we'd love to hear from you so that we can try to tackle those in coming weeks. If you're looking for some good people to read, let me give you two authors that you should pay attention to, maybe three. J.D. Vance is one we already mentioned. He wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy, which was a major bestseller this year. He also writes opinion pieces for the New York Times. He's a very thoughtful cultural voice. Ross Douthat, who also writes for the New York Times. And then finally, on the Christian side, Alistair Roberts, writes long form pieces, but has had some very, very insightful things to say post-election that are full of nuance. And so they're not simple. They're not simplistic. They're very thoughtful and worth checking out. So those are three authors you might want to look to as you sort of try to make sense of the new cultural dynamics that we're living in.
Can I add one more?
Please do.
Anthony Bradley, who is a professor in New York City, African-American guy who writes about the white working class, has said some particularly profound things as it relates to the church in particular. So he's another one. Check out his stuff.
Our hope for this podcast is to equip our own local churches for discipleship and mission. But if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We hope that you join us next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation. In the meantime, shoot us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. And we'll talk to you next week.